We'll hear arguments first this morning in number 1301, Gannett Company against DePasquale. Mr. Bernius, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I represent petitioner Gannett Company, Incorporated, which seeks reversal of the judgment of the New York State Court of Appeals. The question presented by this case is, what restrictions do the First and Sixth Amendments place upon a trial judge who ejects the public and press from a traditionally public suppression hearing in order to prevent press publication concerning that hearing?
Do you place your argument principally on one amendment as against the other, or on both?
Your Honor, I believe our argument is based first on the First Amendment, secondly on the public trial clause of the Sixth Amendment. They are two separate grounds.
Which do you prefer?
I prefer neither, Your Honor. I think they're both equally important. I think the damages in the First Amendment aspect are clear, as are they in the Sixth Amendment. The facts in this case are very brief. The case arises out of the disappearance in mid-July 1976 of a Rochester man while fishing on the Finger Lakes in New York State. Respondents Greathouse and Jones were subsequently arrested for his murder, and in November 1976, a suppression hearing in the case was commenced before Judge DePasquale in Seneca County Court, which is located approximately 40 miles from Rochester. At the beginning of the hearing, the defense attorneys requested that the public and press be ejected, saying that evidence which might or might not be admitted at trial would be heard at the hearing. Judge DePasquale, with no inquiry or argument, and without hearing any evidence whatsoever or making any findings of fact, ejected the public, ejected the press.
Incidentally, Mr. Bernice, is there a transcript of what happened?
Yes, Your Honor. At pages 4 through 6 of the appendix is the transcript of that ejection.
And then was there a transcript made of after the ejection of the proceedings following?
I believe so, Your Honor. Yes.
That transcript's not here?
It is not in the record before this court, Your Honor. It was released after the defendants pleaded guilty, which was subsequent to the time that this special proceeding of prohibition of mandamus was commenced.
Did the trial judge at the time of his original order indicate that the transcript would or would not be available when the case was terminated?
Your Honor,
the trial was terminated?
At the initial ejection, there was no colloquy at all concerning the availability of a transcript in the future. During the hearing, the Rochester newspaper reporter who had been excluded asked for a postponement in order that attorneys might appear and argue. That the postponement was denied, and the hearing finished in secret on Friday afternoon. On Monday morning, attorneys appeared for Gannett, sought vacator of the order of closure, and at that point, since the hearing was over, we asked for access to the transcript. Judge DePasquale heard argument on our motion, but denied vacator of the order and also denied us access to the transcript in perpetuity. After the plea of guilty, he had a change of heart and released the transcript to the public, which was
Has it been lodged with us, Mr. Bender?
No, it has not, Your Honor.
The entire record has not been lodged here?
Your Honor, the entire record is in the appendix. Transcript of the suppression hearing was not part of the record in the appellate division or in the Court of Appeals. This is a separate proceeding distinct from the criminal proceeding. It was a special proceeding.
So your answer is no, the entire record isn't here. That's right.
The record of the criminal case is not before this court.
The record of the trial.
The suppression hearing is not before.
When he entered a plea, a trial at some stage began. I'm trying to separate the pre-trial from what he decided to do finally was to plead guilty, wasn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. There was no trial.
Pre-trial covers all of the things you've been telling us about on the exclusion of the public.
Right.
When you say that this was a separate proceeding, you mean that Gannett's proceeding to obtain release of or access to the suppression motion was in under New York law a separate proceeding from the criminal proceeding?
Yes, Your Honor. What happened were essentially two things. We were notified about this situation immediately or shortly before the suppression hearing in the criminal case ended. That was on a Friday afternoon, and this is an outlying county. On Monday morning, I essentially appeared as an interested party or as an amicus in the criminal case. I went back to Judge DePasquale to ask him if he would change his mind. He did not, and he denied our motion. The next day, we started a separate, distinct civil proceeding of prohibition and mandamus in the appellate division. So this is an appeal.
And the case we have there is Gannett. The title of this case is Gannett.
That's right, Your Honor. It's Gannett against
the criminal.
It's a civil case. It's in the nature of prohibition and mandamus, challenging the orders in a criminal case.
What do you make part of the record on that application?
This case started, Your Honor, with the petition, which appears at page 21, page 19 of the appendix. And the petition challenges the orders in the criminal case, which were issued by Judge DePasquale.
And attached to it as exhibits, was it?
Well, yes. The orders and the transcripts of the criminal proceeding were attached as exhibits in the writ of prohibition.
Incidentally, I take it this was a stenographic transcript, not a tape recording.
That's right, Your Honor. It was a stenographer.
The proceedings are starting 13 on your case. That's all we have on proceedings, right?
Well, what has happened with this appendix, Your Honor, is that things have been put in a chronological order. The transcripts of the...
I mean, is there anything of what happened at the motion other than what is on 13?
No. At the time we started this, that was still secret and it was sealed. When Gannett commenced the separate civil proceeding in mandamus in the appellate division, annexed to those papers were the newspaper articles which had appeared prior to the closure. Now, those articles are irrelevant to justify the closure because they were not before Judge DePasquale. He did not consider them, and indeed, no reference was ever made by any of the respondents to those articles. But I would submit that those articles are directly relevant to the issue before this court because they demonstrate and put in a factual context the opinion of the Court of Appeals. The articles appeared over a course of approximately 2.5 weeks, from the time of the disappearance of this man until the time the defendants were arraigned on the murder indictment. They appeared on 7 days out of that 18-day period. And they appeared contemporaneously with the major events in the criminal investigation. There were articles in the morning and evening paper when this man disappeared. There were another articles when the defendants were arrested, when they were indicted, arraigned, and so on. The last articles appeared at the time of the defendant's arraignment, which was 91 days before the commencement of the suppression hearing. There was no further publicity in that interim period.
Suppose in a criminal trial, Mr. Grinius, either the prosecution or the defense wants to take a deposition of an absent witness, either out of the United States or situated in some way where personal attendance can't be compelled. Would you think the Sixth Amendment and your other arguments would require that the taking of the testimony of that witness be a public open hearing?
If a criminal trial, Your Honor, yes, I do.
And okay, not a criminal trial. I very carefully said before trial, pre-trial.
In a criminal proceeding, yes, it would, Your Honor. I believe that...
What if it's never offered in evidence?
Well, that is, I think, irrelevant. At the time of the proceeding, deposition has all the characteristics of a criminal trial. I would assume that a witness is going to testify. The parties are present. There is an oath. There's cross-examination. The defendant has a right to be present. All the characteristics of the criminal trial itself, the post-jury criminal trial.
Is it not common that in pretrial depositions, both in civil and criminal cases, that particularly if no judge is present, and that's usually the case, that there are many questions which are asked and answered with a reserved right to challenge their admissibility as and if the deposition is offered. Is that not so?
Yes. Yes.
How is it part of the trial until it's offered in evidence?
Well, Your Honor, it is an important stage in the process, and there is a development, an adversary proceeding to develop a factual record upon which a subsequent determination will be made.
Well, will a subsequent determination be made if it's never offered?
Yes.
What will there be for a court to rule on?
Well, it won't be made based on that, but there's no guarantee, and I think it's the analogy to a suppression hearing is clear, that at the time of a suppression hearing, there's no guarantee at all or no that the evidence will in fact be admitted at trial. In fact, there's no guarantee that there will be a trial, but nevertheless, that is the could well be the critical stage in the process. But if the testimony, if the suppression hearing transcript is not to be offered, or the evidence that is given at a hearing is not to be offered at trial, the reason for that is because a judge makes a determination that that evidence is not admissible.
Is that the only circumstance? What if for the party who has called for the deposition just decides it isn't needed and therefore doesn't offer it?
Well, I think that...
Suppose it's the prosecution. The prosecution takes this pretrial testimony in an abundance of caution, and then when they put their case in, they find they've established the same facts by other witnesses, and they never bother to put the deposition in evidence.
Well,
is it part of the trial then?
Not in a strict sense, but in a generic sense, yes, Your Honor. I don't think that the fact that a jury is selected is a mystical concept that precludes the public's right to attend and to observe and be aware of the entire gamut of the proceedings, where there is testimony, where there is cross-examination, where there is an attempt to establish either the prosecution's point or the defense point.
Well, does the Sixth Amendment speak in terms of proceedings, or does it speak in terms of trial?
Well, Your Honor, it speaks in terms, obviously, of a trial. But it's our position that a suppression hearing is clearly, for the constitutional purposes, part of the trial. In fact, the statistics are that 90% of all criminal cases and 100% of criminal cases in Seneca County for 2.5 years, were completed at the pretrial stage.
Well, what if the statistics showed that 90% of the complaints to the prosecuting attorney were never even prosecuted by information or indictment by him? Would that make the prosecuting attorney's conference among his colleagues part of the trial because that was the way so many cases were disposed of?
Well, Your Honor, there is a distinction, obviously, between that situation and the situation where there is a formal proceeding, an adversary proceeding, witnesses are sworn, and a judge is going to make a determination based on that testimony, a determination of fact. I think that really the answer to the question of when does a trial commence is to be found in the purposes that are served by the public trial clause. One of those purposes, obviously, is to protect the defendant, see that his interests are not abused by the prosecuting authorities. But it goes beyond that. There are interests in the public, specifically third parties may have a direct interest in the case, but the interest of the public in seeing that
Why then did the framers cast the language of the Sixth Amendment saying the accused shall enjoy the right of a public trial? Why didn't they say the press shall have access to the trial?
Your Honor, I think that based on the prior history, and which is developed to a certain extent in our brief, but in the amicus brief of the National Association of Broadcasters more extensively, there was really no indication that at common law the right of the public trial accrued to the defendant at all. There were broader purposes behind it, but the codification in the Constitution, I think, recognizes that the defendant should specifically be guaranteed a fair trial, a public trial, but the inherent in that clause, the public trial clause, is a recognition, I would submit, that the public has an equal interest. I think that the purposes that are served by the clause mean that it should not be read literally.
Well, the framers certainly took an odd way of expressing it if they meant to adopt your view.
Your Honor, I don't think so, because it is, again, inherent in that phrase, public trial, is the notion, the concept that the public has an interest in it, and based on the prior history of common law, and based on the purposes served by the public trial clause.
Well, how can you tell what the purposes served are except by reading the clause?
I think, Your Honor, by looking at the history, and really analyzing it in the terms of the essential nature of the guarantee and what it does. The overwhelming purpose served is, as far as I can tell, the insurance of the confidence of the public in the judicial system, in the criminal justice system. The public nature of trials is in effect necessary to the vitality of that system and its viability. I don't think that our criminal justice system would long last if proceedings of this nature were held in secret.
You argue anyway, don't you, that independently of the Sixth Amendment public trial, that the press at least has a First Amendment right to be present.
Absolutely,
you?
Your Honor.
Now, before you get into that, I know you're going to argue it, I hope, but does the public also have a First Amendment right?
I think so, Your Honor, yes. I do. We
you don't
do
claim
not,
any more
no.
for the press than for the public?
Absolutely not. We think that the public right is equivalent to the press
and
right.
And this is First Amendment and not Sixth Amendment.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
When you get to that, do you have any cases from this court that under the First Amendment guarantees access to information?
Your Honor, I believe I have an analogous case history. First, there's no question in this case that the public and the press had a right to be present prior to the motion to exclude them. The Court of Appeals indicated that in its opinion. The respondents concede that. It's the right to be present, I think, derives primarily from the right to gather information, which was recognized by this court in Brandsburg. And I know that the right to gather information is not without limits, but I would submit that if there is any sort of right to gather information, it must exist at trials, it must exist in the streets and other public forums. And I think that for the purposes of the right to gather information, the public forum test, which was developed and most specifically articulated in the Granite case, gives very pertinent guidance.
Will you take that so far as to have the right to be present at a conference of members of an appellate court?
No, Your Honor, because the presence of the public or the press at the conferences of this court or any other court would be basically incompatible with the primary function of the public institution at that time.
Except I thought you based your approach a little while ago on the right to gather information.
That's right, but it's clearly not unlimited, Your Honor. And I think that the court has answered that in some of the prison cases. It's answered that to a certain extent in the public forum cases, Marsh against Alabama, Adderley against Florida, the cases where there's an asserted right to be present to exercise First Amendment freedoms.
Mr. Bernius, what is the primary function of the suppression hearing?
Primary function of the suppression hearing is to determine, Your Honor, whether a jury should hear specific evidence, whether it is sufficiently reliable.
And if the court determines that it should not be heard, and if the press has heard that evidence, is there any restriction on the press publishing it so it will come to the attention of the jury?
No.
So how could the primary function of the suppression hearing be performed, if you're correct?
Well, Your Honor, that is really, I believe, one of the principal faults in the Court of Appeals opinion, the assumption that publication by definition means that the jury will be affected by this information. The orders in this case were aimed directly at publication. They're aimed at keeping the public ignorant of the facts of this hearing. And the basis for the orders is public ignorance with the hope that somehow an indirect benefit will filter back to the trial.
What if the judge modified his order and expressly said that at the termination of the trial, the transcript of the suppression hearing will be made available to anyone who wants it?
Well,
then is there any suppression of information?
Yes, there is, Your Honor. I think that this court in Nebraska Press very much dealt at length with the problems in delaying publication of news concerning the criminal justice system. Secondly,
there you were dealing with the trial, not pretrial, weren't you?
Nebraska Press was a pretrial situation, Your Honor. The delay in this case is just as serious. Secondly, the order in this case is in a sense more dramatic than in Nebraska Press, because not only is there a delay, but there is an absolute denial of the public's knowledge of what went on in a suppression hearing. As an appellate court, this court is well aware of the inadequacies of a transcript, but the tones, inflections, gestures, everything that makes presence of the trier of fact so necessary and to a determination, none of those things can be recaptured in a transcript. And finally,
as Mr. Justice Stevens suggested, if the interests of justice and fairness require that the jury not hear tainted evidence, how is that purpose served? I'm not sure you quite fully answered him. How is that purpose served if the jury hears it indirectly?
Your Honor, we make no argument at all that suppression hearings must be open under all circumstances. We simply say that the damage done to both First Amendment interests and to the public trial interests of the public are serious, and that if closure is to take place, it should take place only as a last resort. What has happened in this case is that the Court of Appeals has said that closure, secret proceedings, are preferable to change of venue, to continuance, to an extended voir dire, all those Shepherd alternatives that this court has repeatedly said in would have been effective to mitigate the effects of pretrial publicity.
If you were in a federal court, you would have some difficulty using change of venue as an alternative if the defendant objected, wouldn't you?
Your Honor, it's clear that if there's a continuance or a change of venue or a voir dire, to some extent it's going to inconvenience a defendant.
What about the vicinage requirement?
The vicinage requirement, Your Honor, deals with the source of a jury. It doesn't really deal with the venue of a case. And I think that the history of the vicinage clause indicates that at the time of the enactment of the Sixth Amendment, there were the districts, the federal judicial districts, were the equivalent of the states, with the exception of Massachusetts and Virginia, which each had two districts. So I don't think that the vicinage clause is of any pertinence here, since it's number one, outdated, and number two, requires the jury from the state. And
Do you think the government could have said, and if this case had been pending in federal court, don't worry about opening the suppression hearing to the court because we're going to move for a change of venue down to Tennessee?
Well, Your Honor, I think that at that point the defendants would have to make a choice, and the fact that venue may be laid in a certain area, the fact that continuance would somehow interfere with a speedy trial, those are considerations that all must be weighed. But I don't think that in this situation, where there are important First Amendment rights and press and public rights, that any one guarantee can be deemed to be absolute. What we're seeking here is an accommodation of all these potentially conflicting values. There is, Your Honor, no conflict in this case. There was no showing that publication would in any sense have prejudiced the defendant's right to a fair trial, and there's also been no showing in this case that ejection or closure of this hearing would have helped to mitigate that prejudice. In fact, I think...
Of course, Mr. Bernius, both defense lawyers moved for the closure on the very ground that they thought they'd be prejudiced. Wasn't that the reason it was closed?
They moved on the basis that evidence which may or may not be admissible at trial was to be admitted at the suppression hearing and asked for it to be closed. I don't really know what that is. We assume that they were concerned with the effects of pretrial publicity. But the concern is not enough, Your Honor. There must be some sort of showing to justify this unusual and, we submit, unconstitutional procedure.
Well, what sort of showing would they make in open court without revealing the very thing they wanted to conceal?
Well, Your Honor, first, the most dramatic example always is a suppression of a confession.
Right.
In many cases, that the confession is not admitted at a suppression hearing. It's not really the issue at a suppression hearing.
The fact that a confession had been made would have to be disclosed, wouldn't it?
That's
and
right.
Would not that be prejudicial to the defendant if it were published in the press? And did you not assert the right to publish whatever you heard at the hearing?
We assert the right to publish whatever we heard, but we already knew that there was a confession, Your Honor, and we could have published that no matter what happened at the hearing. We could have said, and with full...
Well, maybe in this case, but in every case, it isn't true that the press would know whether there was a confession in advance, would it?
Well, the press would know, Your Honor, that there was an illegal search and seizure of evidence, that there was, or there was a confession, or there was an illegal wiretap. They would know generically what was going on at that hearing. And it seems to me, Your Honor, that the fact that a hearing was closed would not diminish the prejudicial impact of a case. It, in fact, would exaggerate it, that the public will assume the worst at a closed hearing.
You're really saying you're a better judge of what's good for the defendant's trial posture than their own counsel.
No, I'm not, Your Honor. But I think that the defendant's rights are not absolutely paramount if there's not a demonstration that they are, in fact, prejudiced.
Did you say we knew here what it was that the defense wanted to suppress?
We knew that it was a confession, Your Honor, and we knew that there were... We knew that there was a gun that had been seized.
But do we know that the motion to suppress identified the items, must have, I suppose, that were sought to be suppressed?
Not specifically.
We don't know. There's nothing in this record to tell us?
No.
What I'm getting at is, I know that the gun was found in Michigan, wasn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
And hadn't the papers already published that before the suppression hearing?
Yes, Your Honor, in July.
But you knew that there was a confession, but you had not printed that?
Absolutely. There was, in fact, the day after...
Absolutely, it was or was not?
There was no reference in any of those articles to a confession, and that's an important point, Your Honor, that the press in this case was responsible. Even in the article the day after the hearing was closed, the reporter did not refer to confessions or guns. She described it as evidence which might have been deemed admissible at trial.
Well, if you had a hearing, I gather one of your protests here is that you should have had a hearing before the order of closure issued.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
And if you had, what would you have argued?
I would have argued that there was no basis for the closure, Your Honor.
Well, on the ground that whatever was the subject of the motion this press had already been published?
That's one aspect to it. That closure would be ineffective because we could... It's not a gag order on the press. They could publish the singularly most prejudicial statement that could be made is that the defendants confessed, and we could have published that.
You said earlier, Mr. Vernius, in response to Justice Stevens, that the defendant's right was not paramount. I think those were your words. You mean it's defendant's right to a fair trial is not paramount?
What I meant to say, Your Honor, is that there must be an accommodation. If a situation arose where the defendant's right to a fair trial was on the line against the public's right, First Amendment and Sixth Amendment rights, we do not say that the defendant's right should not be paramount. But it's important to require the New York State Court of Appeals and trial courts throughout the country not to abrogate the rights of the press and public unless it's absolutely necessary. And that a threat, an actual threat, danger to a fair trial is shown, and there's a showing made that the ejection or closure would be effective. And finally, and most importantly, there's a showing made that the traditional Shepherd alternatives would be ineffective to cure that danger.
Well, Mr. Bernius, suppose in this case there had been a hearing and it had the issue was a confession, and the judge says, I've read the confession, and if the newspapers and the media really do their job in getting the word out, which they apparently want to do, there's going to be a lot of people hear about this, and it's going to make it very difficult to get a jury. And he makes a finding that there is a serious danger to the fair trial rights of the defendant. I suppose you'd take that up on appeal, wouldn't you?
Your Honor, we would obviously have the option of commencing a special proceeding, just as we did.
Well,
in this
I know,
case.
But I know, but you wouldn't lie still for that. I take it. I would just like to know what kind of findings in by the trial judge would that you would accept.
Your Honor, I would submit that the appropriate findings that have to be made are the findings and the articulated in Nebraska Press. And the fact that...
Well, suppose he makes them all.
Certainly there's always the possibility that it could be challenged in a separate proceeding under the law of New York State, Your Honor. But I doubt very much. Certainly
well, what kind of evidence and what kind of danger would you think would have to be present that wouldn't be present when there's a flat-out confession of the crime by the defendant and the interested media? I take it you think it's, in this case at least, it was news.
Yes.
And you were going to, you were interested in publishing the what went on at the suppression hearing?
That's absolutely, Your Honor.
But so you were interested in publishing the confession, if there was one?
Not necessarily.
I didn't necessarily. Were you going to suppress it, or weren't you?
That would be an editorial judgment, Your Honor, and I think that...
Well, you wanted the right to publish it anyway.
We want the right to make that decision.
Yes, you want the right to publish. So what kind of evidence would be sufficient to warrant the judge's conclusion that there's a real danger to the...
A finding that, and a basis for a finding, that change of venue to an adjoining county would not have cured the prejudice. Here we had a circulation of 1,500 newspapers in a population of 36,000 in Seneca County. Mm-hmm. The adjoining counties had 350,000 people, and the judicial district had almost 4 million.
We aren't just talking about the newspapers, are we?
We're talking about the public and...
Well, we're talking about the media, and we're talking about television.
That's right.
Radio.
It doesn't do you any good to talk about 1,500 newspapers.
Well, that's what
we have to talk about television, the reach of television coverage, don't you?
Certainly, and that's not relevant in this case because there's no evidence that there was any television or radio coverage. And in general,
suppose there wouldn't be, would you, if there was an open suppression hearing?
There's nothing to indicate that there was, Your Honor, or would have been.
Do you think they're just going to stay home?
In this case, yes. But as in Rideau, television coverage is certainly relevant and should be considered. But in this case, it wasn't considered. And the effect of a continuance or voir dire should be evaluated.
Mr. Bernius, may I ask you, whether with or without a prior hearing, there'd been no closure order, and you had sat...
And members of the public, however many there were, through the suppression hearing, and at the close of it, and the judge had then issued an order that you not publish until at least after a jury had been chosen and sequestered anything that you heard that day, and similarly address such an order to the general public, whoever they were, present at the time. You'd still be here, wouldn't you?
Yes.
On what ground then?
Under the Nebraska press test, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that...
Justice Visquale apparently anticipated your answer to Mr. Justice Brennan, didn't he?
The colloquy among lawyers who were involved in this, Your Honor, is that this situation is a direct result of the Nebraska press decision. And it's our feeling that the mechanism, even though the mechanism is ejection rather than injunction, the damages are at least as great, and the standards of the Nebraska press should be complied with. Thank you.
Mr. Kobroff?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. The right to a public trial is neither an absolute right of the public nor of the press. Pre-trial hearings and portions of trials have been closed to the public, including the media, for such situations as preventing disclosure of skyjack profile testimony, ensuring the emotional and physical health of a pregnant witness, protecting the identity of an undercover agent, permitting a prosecutrix to testify uninhibitedly at a trial. Respondents admit that the need to preserve an accused's constitutional right to an impartial jury in the county of venue is as important as any of these other interests which have been held to justify closure of criminal proceedings. Respondents Carl Edwin Greathouse and David Ray Jones challenged the admissibility of confessions that they had given to Michigan police and physical fruits that these confessions had led the police to seize. Respondent Judge DePasquale was required to resolve that this evidence had not been obtained in violation of the accused's constitutional rights. The admission of this evidence, these full confessions to the alleged murder and robbery, would undoubtedly have been prejudicial to these defendants at their trial. And widespread dissemination of these confessions prior to trial could nonetheless have predetermined their guilt in Seneca County.
You wouldn't... It would just be a time saver, or would there be anything other than saving your time if there was a hearing about why it was important to close the proceedings, and why some other mechanisms wouldn't suffice?
Well, the New York Court of Appeals has held that the press is certainly entitled to have their views known before the court.
Well, that isn't what the trial judge did, is it?
Well, the situation that was presented to Judge DePasquale was that this motion was made. There were at least three reporters representing three different newspapers in the courtroom. None of them mentioned any objections to it. The district attorney agreed, in effect, with the defendants and their motion.
But they made motions later.
Well, they did, in fact, make motions later, and Judge DePasquale did, in fact, hold a hearing and listen to their arguments. So they did have the hearing.
What kind of determinations did he make? He just denied the motions, didn't he?
No. I mean, Judge DePasquale heard this argument, heard both sides, and then determined that there would be a reasonable probability of prejudice to these defendants had the media gotten access to these confessions and disseminated them. This was his finding.
And did he indicate that some other mechanisms wouldn't be sufficient?
Well, the only reference to that is one of the defense lawyers in the transcript mentions change of venue. That is the only alternative specifically mentioned in the
What does the Court of Appeals think should happen in the normal case?
Well,
did they think something should happen in addition to what happened in the trial court?
Well, they obviously mentioned the alternatives mentioned by this court in Shepherd in the opinion. What you've got here, though, which makes it different, I think, than what these alternatives, these Shepherd alternatives, will do, is here the actual poison had not been put out into the community. We're not in a situation where we're mitigating damage that's already being done, that's already out. We've got a situation where the damage isn't yet been done, it isn't widespread, and we have an opportunity to stop it at its inception.
But the gun is already out.
The gun, that's true, and for that we might well, this isn't the only alternative available to a court to deal with prejudicial publicity. I mean, we have, in fact, the Shepherd measures. They might also have to be used.
Must the exclusion, however, be the last alternative?
Well, the difficulty with exclusion as the last alternative is that if you wait till the voir dire, or if you wait till a change of venue can be done, the hearing's already over. It's too late. Exclusion is a prophylactic, and in a certain situation, unusual situation, and there's no denying this is an unusual case, it is effective, and it should be available to a trial court. It is a fundamental tenet of due process that the conclusions to be reached in a case will be induced only by evidence and argument in open court and not by any outside influence, whether of private talk or public print. Judge DePasquale had the obligation to prevent suppressed evidence from determining the guilt of Greathouse and Jones, and certainly from determining their guilt prior to trial. To prevent the jury from learning of a coerced confession during trial, yet all the while needlessly making it available to them to read or hear of it before trial, mocks the claim that our system of law has always endeavored to prevent even the probability of unfairness. For Judge DePasquale to have allowed public disclosure of potentially tainted evidence which he had the constitutional duty to exclude would involve the court itself in this taint and the illegality. Respondents Greathouse and Jones were out-of-state transients. They were accused of the murder and robbery of a local area resident, Wayne Clapp, a former police officer with roots in the community. They had fled, Respondents and Jones had fled Seneca County soon after Clapp's disappearance, and they were arrested in Michigan several days later. There they allegedly gave these confessions, which were the object of this motion. If they had prevailed at this hearing, they had a triable defense. The people's case was entirely circumstantial. Three men leave on a boat to return. Gunshots are heard, anchors are missing, but there's no body, there's no deceased, no corpse, and no eyewitnesses to any crime.
Was the body ever found?
Never found. However, if they're unsuccessful at the suppression motion, their defense is almost hopeless. Full confessions to the crime, plus the murder weapon itself, is in evidence. This case had already generated extensive media publicity throughout Seneca County.
But when you make that statement, are you basing it on what's in the appendix?
I think we can accept that. I think we can also.
This is far different than in some of the other cases that have been decided here, isn't it? It doesn't strike you as rather routine reporting, factual reporting.
Oh, Your Honor, they claim them to be factual reports, but if, as a defense attorney trying this case, I mean, you would not want to accept that as factual reports. These are untested, unreliable
rumors. Well, I'm comparing
rumors.
It with the material in Murphy against Florida, for instance.
All right. The thing with Murphy is when there was no confession that was confronting that or would possibly have been testified to and it reported in the press. I think that's a major distinction from what he had in Murphy. On the day of the suppression motion, we had three reporters in the courtroom that we know of. Petitioner's reporter, a reporter from the Geneva Times, and a reporter from the Syracuse Post. Together, these papers accounted for almost 85% of the daily newspaper circulation in Seneca County.
Is Geneva the county seat of Seneca County?
No. None of these papers are published in Seneca County. Geneva is in Ontario County, which is a few miles away. The only newspaper actually published in Seneca County is a weekly newspaper.
Where was this court sitting in Seneca?
Seneca County. Oh, in
this. What town?
I believe Waterloo. An additional 6% of the daily newspaper circulation of Seneca County is accounted for by petitioner's Ithaca Journal paper, which it owns and is distributed there. There can be no doubt that this potential...
Well, are these statistics very important?
No, I just want to state them to make the point that, in fact, what would have occurred at this hearing would have been widely and immediately disseminated. I think that three newspapers will not put three reporters in Seneca County Courthouse unless they feel there's a news story and unless they're going to use it. That's the only reason, and the fact that they do have the circulation in that county. Great House and Jones moved for the exclusion of these media representatives. They argued that the deleterious effects of disclosures of the evidence they sought to be suppressed, would outweigh their right to a public trial.
Mr. Kovarov, can you identify what it was they wanted suppressed?
Well, yes. I mean, I know what it was because I've seen the transcript.
I gather it's not in the record before us, though.
Well, they made a motion to suppress physical evidence. The motions were statements made to Michigan police and the fruits that these confessions had led the Michigan
Well, had
police.
There been any publication of what it was that the physical evidence was found in Michigan?
Right. It is clear that the gun was found that Great House led the police to. That was reported. And it was reported that the defendants
had
moved.
You say the motion to suppress also was addressed to statements made to Michigan police?
Oh, yes. They had given statements and written
and
confessions.
And there had been no publication that they had made such statements?
The publication dealt with the fact that New York police were, they gave one statement that Great House had made to the Michigan police when he was captured. That was that he was afraid he'd be shot.
To the extent that all this already had been published.
Well, the substance of the confessions had not been published.
Mm-hmm. Was this down really to the substance of the confessions?
Well, no. I mean, the actual word itself, confession, had been used. They used inadmissible statements.
I understood your friend to say that even though the newspaper reporter knew of it, they had not published it as a matter of their own editorial judgment.
It would appear so. But nevertheless, the accused did not necessarily feel they had to run the risk that when they see three reporters in the courtroom that this might continue. Up to now, they had not gotten the substance of the confessions. They knew that, it had been reported that police were in Michigan interviewing these suspects to learn the apparent motive for the slaying. So they knew that they had gotten something from their interviews, but they didn't know what. And now, on the day of the suppression hearing, they were going to find out what the, quote, motive for the apparent slaying was.
They also had published that he was on probation from San Antonio.
Right, I would say that's not exactly a fact.
That the state police opened to bring the pickup truck back and are still looking for the 357 Magnum revolver, which you later found.
Yes, I think
they had everything in there but the confession.
They had a lot of damaging evidence in there.
But what did they have other than the confession they didn't have that they published here? I'm just halfway through them.
Right. It's the confession. That would
that's
be...
That's the only thing, then, isn't it?
Well, I think in this case, that's the difference, perhaps, between having a triable defense and...
Well, Mr. Cobra, would you be defending this closure if everything that was the subject of the motion to suppress had already been published?
Yes, I think that they could still make their motion.
What justification would there have been for the closure of everything that was subject to the motion is suppressive.
I think that the defense counsel could certainly make the motion. I mean, whether
I'm not talking about the defense counsel. I'm asking what justification would there have been for the order of closure in that circumstance?
The same, that it would threaten their right to get an impartial jury in that county. Simply because the press has this information, simply because the press can publish it, doesn't mean that the defendant is therefore is stopped from trying to,
suggest he is. He can make the motion. I'm just asking why the judge would enter an order of closure of everything all subject
he
to motion.
He might well not. He might
knowledge.
Well not. I mean, he could well take this into consideration and say, well, given the situation, I don't find a threat and I won't do it. On the other hand, he might well say, Well, yes, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to then continue the case, and you've waived your right to a speedy... They might create a whole instances of things he could do, even though the information is out. I'm simply saying that shouldn't foreclose the defendant or the judge from having this power to... this means of protecting the defendant's rights.
Simply. Counsel, in your position, is it solely the protection of the defendant's rights that is involved here? Supposing the New York State Legislature passed a law saying that all criminal trials in the state shall be closed unless otherwise required by the Constitution of the United States, and both the defendant and the prosecutor agreed in this particular case that the trial should be closed. They both moved for it or stipulated to it. Does that raise any constitutional issue?
Well, I would first of all say that I think that's a very unlikely situation.
Would be a rather strange statute, but let's suppose it was enacted.
I think that if such a statute was ever enacted by the state legislature, it might well raise constitutional problems.
What sort of constitutional problems?
The public is the ultimate sovereign. The public has a right to know.
What about a rule of an appellate court or the rule of the governor of New York that his cabinet meetings are going to be private, or the rule of the president of the United States that his cabinet meetings are going to be private?
That's a little different, I think, than perhaps a public trial. Well, by definition, a public trial.
Well, but why do you say by definition a public trial if the New York State Legislature says it's not going to be a public trial?
Well, no, I just meant that in comparison to an executive closure of a cabinet meeting, as compared to that difference.
Yeah,
I think there are...
public trial, you're referring to the Sixth Amendment, I take it.
Yes.
I know, but your argument is that that's a defendant's right.
Yes, it is. I would also say, though, that it's also the public policy of the state of New York and of every other state that there are other societal interests that are advanced by the right of a public trial, independent of an accused's right to a public trial. I think there are two sources.
I was trying to find the Jelke case in the New York Court of Appeals. Do you remember if that's cited in the briefs?
Yes, I believe I cited in my brief.
You do, eh?
Did the judge in this case...
Could you read the citation?
It's 308 New York 56, 123 Northeast 2nd, 769.
308 New York 56.
123 Northeast 2nd, 769.
Did the judge put any limitation on the prosecutor or others releasing statements about a confession?
No,
or
Your Honor, the prosecutor didn't.
Record show how the media found out about...
I believe it was certain of the statements.
The motions made in open court?
Which
were there references to the pistol in the motions in open court?
No, I believe the papers were filed that would have referred to the physical evidence. Those were filed.
But those are public records and they weren't sealed.
No, they were not sealed. I believe, to answer your question, I think that most of the sources of the news seem to be the state police. David Lutwiler was referred to in various of the articles as giving various quotes.
Do you think the threat to the fair trial rights of the defendant are as great from admissible evidence being published ahead of time as inadmissible, or not?
No. The situation isn't the same. I mean, if the evidence is admissible, there's no reason to insulate the jury from it. They're going to hear about it anyway.
Well, I know, but suppose in one voir dire you ask the jury, have you read about this case? They say, oh, yeah, we've read all about it. What do you as a defense counsel do? Say,
I ask a few
shrug
more
your
questions.
Shoulders or not?
No, I ask a few more questions to see exactly what they've read and where they've read it and how it might have affected them.
Well, suppose one of them says, I read a verbatim transcript published in the paper of a suppression hearing which turned out and the evidence was admissible.
Well, I don't think I have cause, but I might not want him anyway.
Do I understand correctly that the transcript of the suppression hearing is now available and is part of the public record?
Yes.
But it was not sent here.
Well, it wasn't part of, this is a collateral proceeding.
Yes, I know.
To the case.
Collateral, but perhaps of some interest.
Yes. But no, it was not sent here.
Could it be?
I suppose so. I tell you, what I do have with me, if Your Honors would want it, is a copy of Judge DePasquale's decision on the hearing. That much I have with me, if Your Honors would want. I don't know how permissible this is. Yeah. Judge DePasquale could not close his eyes to the obvious, needless prejudice to the accused constitutional right that was about to occur. He had the duty to protect the respondents Greathouse and Jones's right to a trial by an impartial jury in the county of Venue, and he did what any prudent judge would have done.
So, do you see any constitutional problems had what Judge DePasquale did say, well, the press may stay and the public may stay, and they heard the whole thing, and at the close of it he said, well, this may be prejudicial, and he issues an order directed to the press and public present?
I don't think he could do that.
You don't
think Nebraska press pretty well decided that issue. Mm-hmm. That's just not available. I mean, and in addition, I think this court has even held in Nebraska press that what occurs at a public hearing cannot be subject to a prior restraint. So that option, it was never even available to him as far as that goes.
Would that fall within what I think Mr. Justice Frankfurter said? Once the cat is out of the bag, it's impossible to get it back in again.
That seems to be the rule.
What was the judge's decision in this case on admissibility?
Certain confessions, certain statements were suppressed, others were not. Certain statements were made, and then he requested an attorney, then more statements were made. What is involved in this case is the constitutional right of an accused to a trial by an impartial jury in the county of Venue, and the right of the public, including potential jurors and media representatives, to have immediate access to pretrial evidentiary suppression hearings. The case does not concern the right of the press to publish free from prior restraints. There were no restraints on press publication in this case. No injunctions restraining the press from publishing anything it wanted to, no contempt citations punishing the press for having published anything. Petitioner's error is in equating a temporary denial of public access to potentially inadmissible evidence with a court-ordered direct restraint on publication. The press was at all times free to publish anything it wanted to about the case of People v. Greathouse and Jones. If the press had learned of what transpired at this in-camera proceeding, their publication of this evidence would have been unrestrained. Petitioner nonetheless argues that the public, including prospective jurors' right to immediate access to this testimony untested by constitutional standards as to reliability, admissibility, testimony found to be probably destructive of an accused's constitutional right to an impartial jury, that this right to immediate access is entitled to the same constitutional protection as the press's right to publish free from governmental censorship. Respondents submit that there is no basis in law or reason for this equation. This has never been the requirement, this has never been the standard of to deny used in instances where courtrooms have been closed. In none of the instances to protect the identity of an undercover agent, to allow a witness to testify uninhibitedly, this has never been the standard used. And such a standard would severely undermine an accused constitutional right to an impartial jury. And without an impartial jury, any other right granted to an accused is meaningless. An important value in our society, a value embodied in the Constitution, is of a trial by an impartial jury in the county where the crime was allegedly committed. This requirement of a fair trial has been interpreted to mean not only the absence of actual bias, but even the absence of a probability of unfairness. To further protect the rights of an accused, our society extends reasonable doubt and presumption of innocence and other burdens in favor of an accused. Before a confession could be offered in evidence against an accused, it must first have been determined by at the least a preponderance of the evidence to have been knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently given. If it is determined that a jury even considered a coerced confession, it is automatic reversal, can never be harmless error. Yet petitioner insists that before a court can exclude the public, including prospective jurors, from a hearing involving a coerced confession that the accused must, in open court, in an adversarial proceeding, satisfy the awesome standard necessary to justify governmental censorship. Respondents submit that this standard certainly gives an accused far less than he has a right to expect in our society and under the Constitution. Petitioner bases his argument on the public and potential jurors' right to immediate access to suppression hearing testimony on the fact that the flow of information to the public concerning pretrial suppression hearings is vital to public understanding of the judicial system. There is no claim here that the press's right to publish is being restrained.
Suppose, Mr. Carver, there was a plea here, so it never came to trial.
Yes.
Being a homicide case, would it have been a sequestered jury?
Perhaps.
And if it had been, would these restraints upon publication of the transcripts of the suppression hearing have been operative?
I would think that they probably wouldn't have been necessary in that case. I mean, if the jury
could have been released,
yeah,
as soon as the jury was sequestered.
I would think that as soon as you have a jury and you can insulate the jury, that the defendant's interests are just no longer in jeopardy. I mean, the threat here is that you've got potential jurors, you've got the prospective jurors sitting in the courtroom, and you've got to insulate them. I mean, you're required to, and this is the means to do it.
But all the newspaper could publish would be the record, the transcript.
Yes, or
they couldn't draw any nuances, anything from how the witnesses appear.
Well, I
yeah,
don't know. I mean, these are edited.
They weren't there, obviously.
Well,
and you don't think that's necessary?
I think that if you have a record that runs a couple of hundred pages, you can simply, by perhaps picking various...
It wouldn't be as good, though, would it?
I don't know.
Well, two is better
it might not be the best of
two
all.
Two is better than one, is it?
Right, right. And that's
well, the record plus the sight of the witness is two.
I agree. I'm simply saying that it's still newsworthy. I mean, this case is moot. It's been moot now for almost 2 years, and it's still newsworthy. You're right, though. But it still, they were there. Well, I mean, you've got it's not an easy decision for this court. I'm not saying it is. I mean, you've got a balancing here. You've got serious rights that are affected.
How does a written news story convey the nuances that you've been discussing?
Well,
any differently from the written transcript? Television would be different. Radio, perhaps.
I tell you, I am not a newspaper reporter. And
you read the newspaper every now and then, don't
yes,
you?
Yes, I've also read some novels that you know.
How do you explain why they sent three reporters and didn't just wait for the transcript?
Well, I think they wanted it immediately. Well, I think they felt this was a good news story, and the next day it might make a...
They wanted to waste their money.
It's their business decision. I don't think the Gannett newspapers does badly making business decisions. The right of access to this transcript has not been denied and is not being denied. This transcript will enable the public to continue to monitor the criminal justice system. It will enable it to assure itself that the accused is in fact being treated fairly, to assure itself that public officials are correctly performing their duties, to assure itself that no judicial or prosecutorial irregularities have occurred. If there is any absolute in our constitutional system, it's that an accused must receive a fair trial before he can be lawfully convicted. Of primary consideration is the public's interest in avoiding anything that would truncate this right. To maintain an accused right to an impartial jury as the arbiter of guilt or innocence, the hearing judge must have the means to ensure that prospective veneermen do not hear matters which by law they ought to be insulated from. Respondents submit that the decision of the New York Court of Appeals reaches a wise balancing between the right of the press to publish free from governmental restraint and the right of an accused to an impartial jury in the county or venue. Respondents submit that the decision of the New York Court of Appeals should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted.